Though we have more questions than answers about COVID-19, many doctors and researchers are working tirelessly to understand how the disease manifests itself differently in both men and women. Joining me today to help shed some light on things is Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirchgraber. She's the Executive Director of the Indiana University National Center of Excellence in Women's Health and former President of the American Medical Women's Association. This special COVID-19 podcast is brought to you by the American Medical Women's Association. I'm Scott Webb. Okay, so thanks for joining me, Dr. Rohr. We know that more women than men seem to get COVID-19, but more men than women die from COVID-19. So what are the sex and gender differences in the manifestation of the disease?
So, Scott, it's really interesting because we don't have all the facts yet. But one of the things we certainly do need is the data. One of the major hassles is that a lot of the information currently is being recorded, but not by sex and gender. So it's definitely important to know how many people are getting infected, how many people are dying, but we need to know more specifics. So that's going to be one of our first pushes. I mean, we've just barely started to look now at what's the race of people that are being infected and sick. But our next step is, I mean, we have to really understand more, not only the ages, but also the sex and gender of those people that are being infected and those people are sick. So I think we're going to find out even more about how this disease affects individuals when we get more data points to review. But there are a couple of different things that we are aware of. So one, yes, we know it seems that more women than men become infected. Now, is that because women are more susceptible or the fact that women are more on the front line, so we have more exposure? We're thinking that it's a little bit more of that. In terms of dying from the disease, that's a difficult thing. We're trying to get a better understanding of if there is a specific sex and gender predisposition, or is it that gender-related activities make you more susceptible to having a bad outcome. And by that I mean, is there something inherent with the X and Y chromosome that makes it different than the XX chromosome women? Or is it that more XY, more men do activities that can make them more vulnerable? So we know that men smoke more, men drink more. Is it those activities that are making them have a worse outcome? But so many things that still have to be understood. But collecting the appropriate data points is going to be very, very helpful. I mean, we know back before 2000, only like 20% or so of the patients that were involved in clinical trials or research projects were women. So we've just been missing huge swaths of data for years and years. And even though those numbers are better now, they're still not where they need to be. So we think that there may be a number of different reasons for why some women do better than men. One of the things might have to do with the level of antibodies. It appears that women who have gotten infected with this disease seem to develop antibody levels. So those antibodies are the things that help to fight off the virus. An antibody is something that goes after that virus and tries to destroy it. It's the reason why we do vaccines. We give you the antibodies with the vaccine so that when your body sees that virus, it can attack it before it has the chance to do any damage. So we know that when women have been exposed to COVID-19, they develop higher antibody levels than the men. Could that be part of the reason why women are doing better and not dying as much? Do we get rid of the infection quicker because we have a bigger defense system? Or is there something else more special about it? Well, you might ask, why is it that women get higher antibodies to this? Well, in general, women are a little bit more susceptible to autoimmune disorders. So autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. Basically, some of those diseases are when the body starts to attack itself. So you develop higher antibody levels to your own self. Because of that, then, are women more likely to develop faster antibody responses to things? Well, that has been shown to be true especially with vaccines. It does seem that women, when we get a flu vaccine, have a stronger response than some of our male colleagues. Does it turn on our system harder and faster than it does for the guys? That may be part of the reason for why we're able to fight off this particular virus faster than the men. But granted, it's still something that we have to figure out, still something that we need to determine. Maybe there are other components to it. We think it's less about hormones, although they may still have a role, because the people that are dying from it are 60 and older. So maybe hormones do have a slightly protective effect. And I don't think we have the data yet to look at the age ranges and the people who die within those age ranges to know if there's a significant difference in older women versus older men and younger versus younger. A lot still to come.
Definitely. And it's pretty striking hearing you speak just how much we don't know. And you've covered a lot there. In terms of what we don't know and the answers that we need to some of these questions, how long does that take?
So one of the most fabulous things to come out of this whole process is the fact that we are now sharing information at a rate that is phenomenally fast. This is not the way science usually works. Usually you put together an article, it's looked at by, you know, all of your colleagues and your peers, and it can take a year by the time you finally have it ready for submission, and then it goes and gets peer reviewed, and it's another 6 months, and then a year later, you know, a year and a half later, it's finally published and somebody reads it, and then there's a big discussion. Nowadays, this information is getting out there like bullets. And that's good and bad. It's good in that we can share the information across international lines. We can share it across disciplines. But it's also a little difficult because that means it's not as greatly scrutinized. So there's a potential for some kind of weird, wacky stuff to get out there and become dogma before it's really tested properly. So I appreciate the speed at which this information is getting out there, but I also am a little bit concerned that we may jump onto bandwagons before we really, you know, have things worked out. The one, I think, fabulous part is that we have so many great scientists that are working on this in a such a collaborative way. They're not holding back. They're just putting it out there and let everybody see it, when in the past you would really kind of hold on to it and make sure nobody else, quote, stole your ideas. I mean, this is just phenomenal. I mean, they honestly think they may be able to have a vaccine within 18 months or less. That's amazing. That's just amazing. And if we can continue to collect the data appropriately, I mean, the information is out there, but we should have it be reported as sex, gender, race, ethnicity, location, socioeconomic status, you know, what about weight? What about blood pressure? What about, you know, comorbid conditions? I mean, all of that is information that I hesitate to say the word available. The information is there. It's just not put into a program that's easily researchable. So the individual doctor knows that their patient has a history of high blood pressure and coronary disease and what their height and weight is and everything else. But that information isn't getting out into a big database that somebody can kind of pull out and extract from. But we're hoping that just at least the bare basics of what's the gender of the patient, what's the age of the patient, what's the race and ethnicity, and what are the comorbid conditions, just getting that piece out there will be really, really helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And it does seem like it's been all hands on deck. And, you know, when you say things like 18 months and how miraculous that would be, you know, for the average person, I'm thinking, well, that's a long time off. We haven't even been, you know, sheltering in place for a month and we're all going crazy already. So 18 months. But, you know, when it comes to these types of things, 18 months would be like light speed, right?
Right. Oh, goodness. Yes, yes. You know, and it might be shorter, but, you know, we're talking about developing a vaccine for a completely new virus, and you want to make sure that vaccine is appropriate and works well, because you don't want to give anybody a false sense of security. They got a shot, now they're fine. No. What they're also working on, though, right now is developing testing for antibodies. You know, so the idea is that if you have had COVID-19 and you have developed antibodies, then you have a little bit more protection. So you may be the person that goes, you know, onto the front lines, or you may be the person that is more comfortable working in the grocery store because you have the antibodies to it, almost like kind of a natural vaccine. The hassle is that those tests are currently being developed. Some are pretty good, some not so great. You really want to have an antibody test that has a lot of sensitivity and specificity. You want that test, if it's negative, to really be negative, and if it's positive, to really be positive. You can't have this kind of halfway sort of thing. So I think even before we get the vaccine completely developed, knowing what who is antibody positive will certainly be helpful. It certainly doesn't mean that if you don't have the antibodies, you can't do anything. You still will have to continue to do some social distancing and being careful. I think this whole process has changed the way we're going to work in this world. It's changed the way that we, you know, interact with others. And hopefully it's gotten people a little bit more aware of good basic hygiene, you know. So I think it's definitely changed the way the world is going to work. But developing really good antibody testing that's easy to do, as well as developing the vaccine, and will be probably the most in terms of being able to help manage this condition as we go forward.
Thinking about what you said, I've never washed my hands so much in my life, you know, and so maybe there's some real good to come out of this. Wash your hands and stop touching your faces. Good stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there seems to be an increase in blood clots in people that have COVID-19. That much we do know so far. Is that related to autoimmunity? And is there a relationship to the use of Plaquenil?
So this is a really interesting thing. And it's only come about more recently as we've had some data coming out from some of these centers that have had a lot of patients. We're not quite sure if it's the virus activity itself that's causing these blood clots, or is it related to the inflammatory process that's going on? Does the inflammatory process kind of stir up the coagulatory pathway, the coagulopathies, and cause these tiny little blood clots? That's something that we're still trying to figure out. What we have found out is that if you use a blood thinner ahead of time, when somebody first becomes sick with COVID-19, it doesn't really seem to help prevent these blood clots. So we're not quite sure. We have to figure out a lot more about how this pathway gets going. But the interesting thing, and the reason why I kind of bring it up with autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and Plaquenil, which is the hydroxychloroquine, the reason I bring that up is because we know that with some autoimmune disorders, for example, lupus, and lupus is a autoimmune disorder that kind of, where your body kind of attacks itself and it attacks multiple different organs, can give you rashes and arthritis. But one of the things it can also do is cause what we call an antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. And basically, this is an autoimmune disorder in where your body attacks itself and creates little blood clots. One of the treatments for it is Plaquenil, which is a hydroxychloroquine. So is it that in some patients who do better with hydroxychloroquine, that it has more to do with the clotting than it does with the actual virus or the other manifestations of the viral infection? So, man, that's why it's just so fascinating. I think medicine is just amazing because there's so many different ways to look at something, and you have to try and figure that piece of it out. I mean, currently, a lot of the studies are adding in Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine to patients that are really ill with COVID-19. But we don't really know of those patients that are ill, what's the subset that have a coagulopathy? And is it that subset where it would be better to be used than the other? Because there can also be some negative complications with the use of this medication. So, you know, still a lot to be figured out. A lot to be determined, There's multiple different ways of kind of looking at this. So we're trying to kind of figure out, could that autoimmunity, especially that associated with clotting disorder, have some relationship with the times where Plaquenil can be useful versus the times when it's not. And we know, for example, again, that autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus are more common in women. And more women are on this medication to treat those disorders. So I think another really interesting thing would be to kind of look at those women, those patients who are using this. Is there any change in the terms of their ability to get this disease or change in their outcome? Still to be determined.
I could listen to you all day. I just love hearing the passion in your voice and how, for as long as you've been doing this, just how excited you are at these challenges and finding the answers to these questions. I can hear it in your voice, and it makes me feel, you know, just as a normal American citizen, that with doctors like you trying to figure this stuff out, like, we've got a chance, you know, we're in good hands. It's really amazing, Dr. Rohr. Anything else we can tell listeners today? We've covered a lot, but anything else we need to tell them?
I want all of our listeners to be very thoughtful about how their actions can impact others. And so when we talk about stay home, we really mean it. And what you will do has impact on us. If you get sick because you felt like you really needed to go bowling or you really need to go work out at the gym, just think about how many potential people you could infect. Some of them your own family, but also your healthcare workers. Also the janitor who's going to come in and have to swab your hospital bedroom, you know? Also the food cafeteria worker who's taking your dirty trays back down. There's so many people that you can impact. Always be thinking about how your actions are going to implicate or impact what you do and impact those around you. So still follow the guidelines. Don't listen to crackpots. Get your information from reliable sources. And as much as you can, stay home, stay healthy, and follow the guidelines that are put out by your public health officials. They're the ones that are really doing the hard work.
Dr. Rohr, so great having you on. You are so knowledgeable. Your expertise brings me comfort. I hope it did for the listeners as well. I would love to have you back. Thank you so much.
Anytime, Scott. Thanks again. Keep up the good work.
That's Dr. Teresa Rohr Kirchgraber. She's the Executive Director of the IU National Center of Excellence in Women's Health and former President of the American Medical Women's Association. For more information, visit amwa-doc.org and use the keyword search COVID. And thanks for listening to this special COVID-19 podcast from the American Medical Women's Association. I'm Scott Webb. Stay well, and we'll talk again next time.